Amanda, remember that time a butcher pretended to be a baronet?
Hello, and welcome to Remember That Time, an historical podcast. I'm your host, Amanda Webb.
And I'm your host, Anna Webb, and this is a podcast where two sisters totally geek out about all their favorite moments in history.
A little behind the music for you. we do a video call when we record these, and each of us work on two screens. And for Anna, the camera is on screen one, but my face is on screen two. And so I was like, wait, I always give a little bit of silence at the start so I can edit it out, whatever. And I went to give the thumbs up, and it looked like she wasn't looking at me at all.
I was like, hey,
we're ready. I'm ready to go. But you were fully looking at me the whole time, and it's just making me laugh.
My notes are on the one where the camera is, so it's going to look like I'm looking at you for most of it.
Right.
It's just easier this way. Sorry.
Just made me laugh. I thought it was funny.
Would you like a drink update?
Of course.
I'm having a little beveragino I've put together here.
Oh.
I bought some tiny bottles of sangria.
Love that.
On a whim today.
Love
and
that.
And also on a whim, I bought cranberry ginger ale. So I've mixed them and made a sort of sangria spritzer. It's delicious.
That sounds delightful. I'm drinking water.
Much less involved.
As I always am.
Okay, so this episode, I'm really excited about it. Amanda said, I know nothing about this, when she, opened my notes to see, what the topic was. And I didn't really know much about it either. I was feeling uninspired this week, and I wanted to find something, a little off the beaten path, something maybe other people know a lot about it, but I didn't know anything about it.
I don't even know the name. I don't even know who this is.
Yeah, and I was like, okay, I wanted drama.
I
was looking for some drama. So this story has everything. We've got rich people. We've got a shipwreck. Scamming and scandal. We've got weird lawyers. I'm so excited.
It's fun. I love this.
And I just want to say I used a couple of law articles in this, and I'll give the names as I get to them in my notes because I don't want to scroll through and find them right now. But if you are looking for, because we're going to talk about a legal case here, and if you're looking for more information on all the players in the, in the courtroom, and because we can't really go super in depth into that because it's a lot of information and this is already long. So if you're looking for more, I'll give you the names of the articles as we come to them here in my notes. And I recommend reading them. I found them for free on JSTOR, so easy.
Great.
Easy. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm changing the perspective because I don't like how I'm sitting, but I am ready. And you can just
picked up her whole computer. Okay.
You can just go ahead and go, and I will just be moving all of my items around.
What is going on today? Okay. So we're going to talk about a family here first. And I have to give you some background on the family. So you'll understand just this kind of groundwork. Okay. So we're talking about this family, the Tichbornes. The Tichbornes are a prominent English Catholic family. They are very loyal to the crown. So in 1621, a member of this family, Benjamin Tichborne, is created a baronet for his services to King James I. So this family goes back a while.
Yeah.
We're not staying in James's time, but that's just where we are beginning.
Anytime I see him, my man.
I know.
The one, the only.
And actually, James I created this rank.
Of course he did. Oh, he was just left and right. You get a knightship. You get a lordship. Right, yeah. What's this? A baronet? I don't know what that is. Have fun.
They rank just below barons and above knights, basically. So
so a truly, truly made up position.
Well, it's all made up, let's be honest.
But, like, there are two positions there you could have given to a person. And he said, no, I don't like you enough to be a baron. Why not a teeny baron? Yeah, a baronet, as it were.
Basically, it. They're kind of, like, slightly lesser nobles, from my understanding.
Sure. Why not? Whatever you say, James.
Okay, so we've got now this line of baronets in this kind of noble family, right?
Okay.
So we're going to get to Sir Henry Tichborne, who is the seventh baronet. At one point, he's traveling in France, and the Peace of Amiens breaks out in May of 1803, which reignites the Napoleonic Wars. And I promise this is all going to just be relevant. It's just good background to get to the person who's important in this case.
Okay.
And he is considered an enemy citizen because of this. And so they capture him, and he's detained by the French authorities, and he's held in captivity for like several years. And while he is imprisoned, there are other people who are imprisoned with him, including his fourth son, James.
Uh-huh.
And another person of nobility in England, Henry Seymour of Noyle.
Okay.
Okay. So, Henry Seymour has an affair at some point, which produces a daughter. Her name is Henriette. And she's born about 1807. And Henriette then grows up. And by the time she's like in her 20s, and she's not married, her father, Henry Seymour, is like, we need to get you a husband. And he's like, you know who would be great?
This guy I met in prison.
That kid I was imprisoned with. Not the dad, the son, James. Yeah. He's like, how about James?
Why not?
And so they get married. And they get married August of 1827. And then on January 5th of 1829, Henriette gives birth to a son who is our major player today.
Okay.
Kind of. Roger Charles Doughty Tichborne.
I truly have no idea where this is going to go from here.
I know.
This is so much intricate background. Like, there's so many pieces here.
I know. And the notes are long because there's a lot of this.
I love it.
Okay. So we have Roger. Roger Tichborne. We're going to talk a lot about Roger. So let's talk a little bit about baronetcies.
Baronetcies.
Sure. I don't know.
Let's just make this as hard as possible.
So they are passed only through male inheritance. Classic. Right? Now, I think that you could get the title as a woman if, like, you were married to a baronet and he died and had no issue or something. I don't know exactly.
It just wouldn't be passed on.
Right. That's not really relevant to today. So, James.
So would it be the baronetess? That sucks. Because you have the baron and the baroness.
I don't remember.
So would it be the baronet and the baronettess? That's horrendous. So. James, big L. This is not it, buddy.
I know. Okay, so remember James Tichborne, the guy that they were like, he should marry my daughter.
Yes.
Remember how I said he was the fourth son?
Yes.
Of the then baronet?
Yes.
Okay. So he has three older brothers. The first one dies with no male heirs. That he had seven daughters, but he had no men, so none of them could inherit. His second oldest brother dies unmarried, no children.
Okay.
So his third oldest brother, you know, the one right above him, uh-huh. Edward, becomes the next baronet.
Sure.
Edward has two children, a boy and a girl, but the boy dies. So
no male heir.
Childhood. Yeah. So he doesn't have a male heir. So that means when Edward becomes baronet, James becomes next in line, and then his son Roger comes after him.
Right. Yes.
So that's where we are at this point in time.
Yes.
Okay, so let's talk about Roger.
Okay.
Roger Tichborne is raised mostly in Paris by his mother. His parents have a very unhappy marriage. So despite the fact that they have three other kids together, two daughters and a son, both of the daughters die in infancy. And Roger has a younger son named Alfred. And that's important. But they don't, the parents don't live together because they don't really like each other.
Okay.
So classic. Roger, she takes Roger with her to Paris. And so he's raised mostly there. He speaks mainly French. And his English is heavily accented because of how much he speaks French. And this is important. I need you to remember all these details, okay?
Okay.
Because we're talking about a legal case here, and all of the details about Roger are
important. Are going to become important.
Yeah. Okay. In 1845, Roger's father, James, decides that actually he should finish his education in England.
Why not?
So he brings him back, and he puts him in the Jesuit boarding school, Stonyhurst College.
Oh, the Jesuits.
Mm-hmm. Those guys.
Oh, the Jesuits.
And he stays there until 1848. I just had a complete panic that maybe I wasn't recording this whole time.
That would have been horrendous.
In 1849, Roger sits the British Army entrance exam. And then he takes a commission in the 6th Dragoon Guards. And he serves there for 3 years, mainly in Ireland.
Wow. A well-traveled young man.
Oh, Amanda, we're not even there yet. So when he would be on leave from the army, he would frequently stay with his uncle, Edward, the baronet, at Tichborne Park in Hampshire, which is like the family's main property, though they have others, of course, because they're nobility. And Roger, like, gets real intensely in love with his first cousin Catherine, Edward's daughter.
Love that, but always.
Great news, though, Amanda. Catherine's parents are like, marriage between first cousins? I don't think so.
Oh my god! What year is it?
It's in the Victorian era, Amanda.
What year is it? That's fabulous!
It's late 1840s.
They were finally starting to get it.
Yeah, at least
they really
family.
Understood.
They
yeah.
didn't want it. So Edward forbids them from seeing each other, though they do still see each other sometimes in secret. They, you know, but they weren't allowed to get married, that's for sure. And this really frustrates Roger. And so he decides that he is going to take some overseas military duty so that he doesn't have to stay with his family much anymore. And then, but the regiment is like, actually, we're staying in the British Isles. So he resigns. And he's like, I gotta go.
So funny.
He's like, I gotta go. So on March 1st, 1853, he decides that he is going to take his own private tour of South America. And he leaves on board La Pauline, bound for Chile. So, while he is abroad, Sir Edward, the baronet, dies in May of 1853, which makes Roger's father, James, the new baronet, and Roger the heir.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes. Following with you, for now.
Okay. Well, okay, that is mostly, like, the end of the complicated family.
Okay. Because now he's... The next in line.
Yeah, just, and he that's has a younger brother, so nothing has really gotten complicated again.
Yet. Right.
Okay. So, Roger's traveling in South America. He spends about 10 months there, and in the beginning of his trip, a servant comes with him, John Moore. Lock that name up in here. John Moore.
Okay.
So, but while they're traveling, John gets sick, so they, like, pay him for coming on the trip, and they say, you should just stay where you are. And he does. He stays in Chile, so he doesn't finish the trip with Roger. Okay. Roger goes to Peru. He takes a long hunting trip while he's there. And by the end of 1853, he's back in Chile, and he decides that in the new year, he's going to cross the Andes. So, at the end of January, he makes it to Buenos Aires, and we know he gets there because he writes a letter to his aunt letting her know that he is going to go to Brazil, then Jamaica, then Mexico. Those are his plans. And we also know that he gets to Brazil because there are sightings of him in Rio, in April of 1854 while he's awaiting sea passage to Jamaica.
Okay.
Following?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Despite the fact that he doesn't have a passport, he is able to get onto a ship called the Bella, which is setting sail to Jamaica. And this is on April 20th of 1854 when he boards the ship. And then on April 24th, 1854, a capsized ship with the name Bella is discovered off the Brazilian coast.
Mm.
And there is wreckage, but there are no people. So they assume that it's all hands lost.
Interesting.
So we've got ourselves a shipwreck.
Okay. We and love Roger a shipwreck.
Roger Tichborne was on board.
Right. Because the last time he was seen was waiting for that boat.
Right.
Got it.
So in June of this year, the Tichborne family are told that we just have to presume that Roger is lost. There are some rumors that another ship has picked up survivors and taken them to Australia. So there's, while the authorities are like, everyone is gone, because people are talking, there's some hope that maybe Roger isn't actually dead.
Uh-huh.
And then in June of 1862, Sir James Tichborne, remember, the baronet,
uh-huh. Roger's dad,
dies.
Okay.
So Roger at that time would have become the 11th baronet, but he's presumed dead. So the title instead passes to his younger brother, Alfred.
Okay.
I know it's a lot of information.
I'm with you. I'm keeping with it.
Now, Roger's mother, Henriette, who we're going to be calling Lady Tichborne from now on, because she's like the Dowager Lady Tichborne, you know?
Right. Yes.
She doesn't want to believe that her son is dead. She is convinced that he's still alive out there. And she speaks to a clairvoyant, and this clairvoyant tells her, oh, he's definitely alive. And he's probably in Australia, because that's what everybody's saying. So she starts taking out newspaper ads in the Times, offering a reward for information about Roger and the fate of the ship. So, for the most part, the ads don't really produce anything. But then, Lady Tichborne hears of this man in Australia named Arthur Cubitt, who runs this thing called a missing friends agency. He puts out notices to find missing people, basically.
Huh.
And she writes to him and says, my son's missing. Can you help? And he says, yes, I can. So he starts putting ads in Australian newspapers because that's where they think he is.
Sure.
If he is alive, right?
Uh-huh.
So the ads give details about the Bella's last voyage, describe Roger, and here is how he's described, okay? Also important. Get lock it in. Ready to lock in, okay?
Okay.
He is described as, quote, of a delicate constitution, rather tall, with very light brown hair and blue eyes. He is a skinny mini, you know? Mm-hmm. And so they're offering a big reward for any information that will say either he is alive or dead. They're going to give a reward either way, basically.
Okay.
Okay, so it is now October of 1865, and your man Cubitt writes to Lady Tichborne, and he's like, okay, there's this lawyer in Wagga Wagga in Australia. His name is William Gibbs, and he has been dealing with this butcher who has gone bankrupt, and that person's name is Thomas Castro. And Thomas Castro has told this lawyer, I am actually Roger Tichborne.
Uh-huh.
He mentions that he actually is entitled to some property in England. And this guy's like, how could you possibly? And he's like, I'm Roger Tichborne, right? And he also kind of talks about experiencing a shipwreck. He's also smoking a briar pipe that has the initials RCT.
Interesting.
Okay. And so, yeah, when the lawyer presses him, he's like, that's me. I'm Roger. We are going to call him the claimant for pretty much the rest of this, just because it's like a lot of names. He's also sometimes, if you're looking this up, he's also sometimes called Arthur Orton. And we're going to come back to Arthur. Okay?
Okay.
A lot of names. Are you following?
I think so.
So we've got Castro claiming to be Tichborne. He might also be Orton. But okay. We are going to call him the Claimant.
Okay. The Claimant, TM.
Correct. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So, with the encouragement of the lawyer, the claimant writes a letter to Lady Tichborne, and he's like, I'm your long-lost son. Okay? It's me. He does refer to her as the wrong name. He addresses it to, like, Hannah or something, which is not her name.
So this feels like a whole lot of nothing.
Well, Amanda, you would think that. He refers to a lot of different Tichborne properties that aren't actually their properties.
Uh-huh.
And he talks about his former life, but it's all very vague.
Okay.
He doesn't hear back from her right away. So in 1866, he goes to Sydney. And he starts getting money from banks on the basis of this declaration that he has made that he is Roger Tichborne. I'll be able to pay it back because I'm Roger Tichborne.
Okay.
Lots of errors in his written statement. But the birth date and the parentage details are correct. So I guess that's enough to convince these banks to be giving him money.
That's wild.
It does include a brief account of how he had arrived in Australia, basically saying, like, okay, our ship was going down. This other ship called the Osprey picked us up. It was going to Melbourne, so it brought us here.
Uh-huh.
And he says that when he arrived in Australia, he took the name Thomas Castro from some acquaintance. And he settles in Wagga Wagga. He marries a pregnant housemaid, Mary Ann Bryant. And he treats her child as his own. And then later they, I think, have another one, maybe. They have another one in March of 1867.
Wow.
So, on September 2nd of 1866, the claimant leaves Sydney to head to England with his wife and children. And he arrives there on Christmas Day.
Okay.
And he calls on Lady Tichborne when he arrives, but is told that she's in Paris. So he can't see her right away. And then he makes a trip to Wapping in East London. And he starts asking about a local family named Orton.
Huh.
He finds out that they have actually left the area. He tells people that he was like a neighbor and a friend of this guy, Arthur Orton. And he's telling everybody like, oh, this guy, Arthur, he's super wealthy in Australia now.
This guy that he's pretending to be?
No. Arthur. He was pretending to be Roger Tichborne. He was going by the name Castro.
Right, but wasn't he also sometimes pretending to be Arthur?
No.
What was that?
He's not pretending to be Arthur.
Okay.
He is now sometimes known as Arthur.
Oh, now.
But he is not pretending to be Arthur. He's telling people now he knows this guy, Arthur.
Okay.
So just keep it all in your little brain, all these little names. Okay. There's a lot going on, but it's important.
Yeah.
Okay. He hires a solicitor, or as we would say, a lawyer. His name is John Holmes. And he says, come with me to Paris to find my long-lost mommy, Lady Tichborne. And so they do. And they meet her on January 11th, 1867 at the Hotel de Lille.
Okay.
And Lady Tichborne immediately is like, yep, that's my son. That's my boy. I know him. That's him.
I don't know about that, though.
Now, I want to make it incredibly clear. It's right away. And I just want you to remember that.
Okay.
And the lawyer is like, okay, so you need to talk to the British embassy and give them a signed declaration where you are testifying that this man, the claimant, is your son. So she does. And she also decides she's going to give him an income of £1,000 a year. And she goes back to England with him to declare her support to the rest of her family. And the rest of the Tichborne family is like, nah.
That's not That's him.
That's not him. So I want to read this quote, and this is from one of the articles that I mentioned before. It's called The Tichborne Case. It's an article from the Yale Law Journal, and it's by William J. Kinsley. And it says, quote, "One of the strangest occurrences in this or any other identity case was that Lady Tichborne identified this coarse, rough, ignorant, burly man of 250 to 300 pounds as the rather undersized young man whom 13 years before she had parted when he was 24 years of age." So this dude looks nothing like him in terms of, you know, size, general demeanor. He's nothing like him.
So is she just falling fully into her own delusion?
I guess, yeah. She's convinced, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, to be fair, she's not the only one. There are other people who support the claimant, including the Tichborne family's lawyer and their doctor. And but the rest of the family are just like, they're so unconvinced. They're like, no way, he's a fraud. It's definitely not him. And by this time, importantly, Roger's younger brother, Alfred, who you will remember had become the baronet, mm-hmm. has died. He dies.
Oh, so he doesn't even have to try and kick this guy out.
However, Amanda, Alfred has an heir.
Oh.
It is his infant son, Henry. So it's like kind of convenient, actually, that it's a baby.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, right?
Well, now this guy's just trying to fight a baby.
Well, he's trying to fight the rest of the adults who are trying to preserve this title for the baby. But
this made-up title. This is all James's fault.
It's all James's fault. You're totally right. I mean, look, it's not like when you're a king, like, he doesn't have to do anything. Nobody has to serve in his place, this baby.
Right.
He just, that stuff just all belongs to him now, basically. Right. Right?
The land and the money.
Yeah. So even Lady Tichborne's brother, Henry, says that this claimant is not him. And importantly, a big part of that is that the claimant does not speak or understand French.
What?
And he has absolutely no trace of a French accent, which, if you will recall, Roger did, despite the fact that he was English. French was functionally more like his first language.
Right? And, like, it hadn't been that long.
No.
That he would have forgotten French. And here's the other thing. Is like, okay, let's say he fell into a coma, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Or he had some mm-hmm. sort of brain memory damage. Lost. Or memory loss. Your native language is not typically the one that you lose. Your second language is.
Right.
When you lose language with something like that, you will often lose your first, your second language, but not your first. Like, you revert right. back to your first language.
Right. And I mean, I guess technically English is his first language, but he spoke French so much that his accent was affected.
Yeah.
You know? So, I don't know.
Seems sketch to me.
So the claimant initially files his claim to the title and the estates on June 27, 1867. And on July 31st, 1867, the claimant undergoes a judicial examination mm-hmm. at the Royal Courts of Justice. And he testifies there that after his arrival in Melbourne in July of 1854, he had worked for William Foster at a cattle station under the name of Thomas Castro. And while he's there, he meets a young man named Arthur Orton, who is a fellow Englishman. And he leaves the employment at the cattle station after a while. And he says that he and Arthur would kind of travel around the country. Sometimes he was with Arthur, sometimes he wasn't. But they would work in different jobs. And then eventually he sets up working as a butcher in Wagga Wagga in 1865, which is, of course, where the lawyer found him.
Right.
So the Tichborne family sends an investigator to Australia. They're like, all right, we're going to check out your story. And they speak with William Foster, the guy he worked, the cattle guy he worked for. They speak to William's widow. And she's like, no one named Thomas Castor ever worked here, but someone named Arthur Orton did work here. And she identifies the picture of the claimant as being Arthur Orton.
What the heck?
She's like, that guy who says that he was going by the name Thomas Castro, but now is saying that he's Roger Tichborne. I know him to be Arthur Orton. This guy that the claimant says he met and kind of traveled around with.
This is wild.
There's a lot going on. I told you there was drama.
Yeah. I love it.
Okay. So, when he files his claim, Lady Tichborne does acknowledge in writing that this is her son, but it's like not in the proper legal form to introduce during a trial, so it doesn't really count. And then she, on March 12th, 1868, dies.
Oh.
Before any of this like goes to trial, right?
So he's just lost his whole case then.
He's lost his biggest supporter and his biggest source of income. Yeah, he ain't got money anymore because the family's not giving him money.
And now a baby is in charge.
A baby is in charge. So his other supporters set up a fund for him, which provides him with a house and an income of £1,400 a year. Which, by the way, in 2021 would be equivalent to £130,000.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. He does eventually go bankrupt because he's just spending all this money. And in 1870, his new legal advisors at this time start a new fundraising scheme called the Tichborne Bonds. And in this scheme, you could buy a bond for £100 with the promise that it will be repaid once the claimant is granted his inheritance.
Right.
And through these bonds, they raise about £40,000. Okay, so he's raised a little bit of money, but then the Franco-Prussian War happens, so things get delayed for a little while.
Yeah.
There are, like, some key witnesses in Paris, because, remember, he, like, grew up in Paris, so they want to talk to people from his childhood.
Sure.
So they can't get out of Paris because of this war, so things get a little delayed. But finally, in May of 1871, the civil case that the claimant has opened comes to court. So this case is Tichborne v. Lushington. And you're like, who's that?
Yeah, who is that?
Colonel Lushington was the current resident at the time of Tichborne Park.
Oh.
So the claimant is basically suing him to say, you got to get out. I'm evicting you.
And I'm in charge of all of this.
I am going to claim the property as my own as Roger Tichborne. So
okay.
What the consequence, of course, is that he has to prove that he's Roger Tichborne.
Right.
Right. So that's really what it becomes about. Less about evicting the guy, more about proving that this is...
Right, because then it would be easier for him to make the rest of his claim. If, like, he proves in this legal case that he is that guy.
But if he fails, everybody knows he's an imposter. Like, because he can't then say, well, that wasn't really what the case was about. No, but
I'm still him.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, just to set the stage of the estate... It's Tichborne Park's 2,290 acres.
Okay.
Plus there are other manors and lands and farms in Hampshire. And then some other properties in London and some other places. Altogether, the estate produces an annual income of over £20,000.
Okay.
And in 2021, that would be equivalent to £1.98 million.
Goodness.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
So this trial takes place in the Court of Common Pleas before Lord Chief Justice Bovell, and it begins on May 11th, 1871. Again, go read the article I mentioned before. The other article is The Tichborne Cases, The Story of a Bold Imposter, and it is from the American Bar Association Journal, and it's by Frank Courtney Nicodemus Jr. So if you're looking for
Nicodemus.
More, like, in-depth details on the case, I recommend those articles. But
okay.
So some of the information here comes from that, but I'm just not going super into detail. So during the trial, the claimant and his team call 80 witnesses.
Goodness gracious.
And the family, which represents the Lushington side of this case, they only call about 17. And so the reason is that they don't need to call more.
Right. And that also tells me that he was just paying people off. Come lie and say that I'm this guy.
Well, you would think so, Amanda, but we'll come back to it.
Or, like, did you meet him once? Come tell everybody.
No, there are lots of people who believe that he is the guy. Lots
doesn't
of
he looks nothing like him and he sounds I nothing know. Like him. I don't understand.
I know.
It's wild.
The trial lasts 103 court days.
Good Lord.
Those are the days they're in court. It's long, long, long. So the first witnesses for the claimant are like former officers and people from Roger Tichborne's regiment.
Okay.
People who served with him. And all of them are like, yeah, that's definitely the guy. Also, lots of servants and former servants of the Tichborne family come forward and say, that is him.
Uh-huh.
One of those being your man, John Moore, who I told you to lock away, who traveled with him.
Uh-huh.
He says, yeah, this guy remembers lots of, like, small details from our time traveling together. He remembers what clothes we were wearing. He remembers the name of, like, the dog that we kind of adopted on our travels. He's definitely the guy.
Okay, so so here's the thing, is that I don't believe that this guy is Roger. But I'm trying to figure out who he is. And, like, why he would know these people. I know. But that's from my perspective. Now that's what I'm trying to piece together is, who is this guy? Because it's not him. There's no way that it's him. So who is he? And why does he know all of this?
Well, he does testify.
Okay.
He's very vague. And he's very evasive under cross-examination. And by
color
the way,
me shocked.
The guy they get to cross-examine him is, like, the best cross-examiner in the country, basically.
Okay.
Like, he's tough, right? And he asks him, his name is Hawkins, by the way, the last name of the cross-examiner guy. He starts asking him, like, why did you go to Wapping in London? You remember? You made a trip there?
Right. To ask about Arthur, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he's kind of dodging the questions, and then he asks the claimant, are you Arthur Orton? And he says, I am not.
Okay.
On the stand, he says he's not. He is really, he doesn't seem to remember any of his time at Stonyhurst, the school that he went to.
Okay.
He can't identify Virgil, and he confuses Latin and Greek, and he doesn't really have any understanding of chemistry. All things which he would have studied in school, and was actually pretty well known to be. Like, Roger was well known to understand Latin pretty well, so why would
so
you not know the
difference? So he clearly doesn't have a sort of, like, higher level, richer educational background.
And again, like, sure, maybe he had memory loss, right? But it's like he can remember all these little details, but not things that he would have learned and would be part of his, like, long-term memory.
And that, to me, says that's somebody who has studied the details because they think that's what they're going to get caught on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So, they take an adjournment for a little while, and then they come back on January 15th of 1872, and at that point, Sir John Coleridge, who is representing the Tichbornes in this case, along with the other guy, Hawkins, he starts his opening statement to the jury because, you know, Roger's team present their case first and then the Tichbornes refute it, basically. And he starts his opening statement on January 15th, 1872. And the opening statement continues for a month.
What?
And it becomes the longest ever achieved in an English court.
What? Is it just because he has so many, like, facts to present that negate everything that he has said?
Correct.
That's hilarious. A month long rejection of your story is maybe the funniest thing I can imagine.
That is harsh.
And you're going to come in tomorrow and you're going to hear me tell you again how you're lying. Yeah, and you're going to come in tomorrow and you're going to hear me tell you again how you're lying.
Totally. Yeah. Now, what an interesting piece of testimony. Again, I'm not going into all of it, but this other nobleman, Lord Bellow, testifies because he had gone to school at Stonyhurst with Roger Tichborne. And he gets on the stand and he testifies that Roger had distinctive tattoos.
Oh.
Which the claimant does not have.
Oh.
So.
Interesting. Well, that should have done it right there.
Well, it probably did. So on March 4th, the jury notifies the judge that they've heard enough. They're like, we actually don't need
You're
to
actually
call
good.
Witnesses.
You're good, actually.
Right. Because the Tichborne's representation had more than the 17 witnesses lined up. But the jury said, we got it.
We've heard all we need to hear.
Yep. And so they did say that the evidence on the whole was what convinced them. It wasn't just the tattoo testimony, but that was pretty strong.
That was the point where they were like, oh, wow. So we really, really don't need to hear anything else now. Yeah, yeah.
So the judge, finds in favor of the Tichborne family and then the claimant is arrested on charges of perjury. Because remember, he is sitting on the stand saying, I am this man. So he's committed perjury.
Yeah, 100%.
So he's immediately committed to Newgate Prison. Bail is refused and he's confined there for 2 months. Eventually, he's granted a £5,000 bail and it is paid by some other, like, higher up, kind of more noble people who believe his side of the story.
Okay.
While he is in prison on March 25th of 1872, he publishes in the Evening Standard a quote, appeal to the public, requesting financial help because he's got legal costs and when he gets out, he'll have living costs. So he's trying to raise some money.
I just lied in court about becoming a small-time nobleman. Will you pay for my legal fees?
Well, Amanda, he has actually gained a lot of support, and this
is interesting
to me because a lot of working-class people support him because they perceive him as this person, like a working class person who has been denied justice in the courts, which is so interesting to me.
Uh-huh.
Because they're like, this guy, he's just being they're being prejudiced against him because he's a working class guy,
but the guy he's pretending to be isn't a working class guy.
I know.
So really, listen,
I'm with you.
Being deceitful to the government. That's so fun.
We love ripping off rich people, frankly.
We love ripping off rich people.
He can't be both.
However, do you love him ripping off rich people or do you love that he's a rich person? Because that's not the same.
I know.
We love being messy. That's so fun.
I know. But he's got a lot of support. And so these little support committees start forming throughout the country. lots of meetings are held in, like, the big halls and cities and towns in England, like, between this civil trial and the criminal trial that's coming up because he has committed perjury. Lord Rivers, who is, another nobleman, and some other prominent members of parliament, barristers, important citizens in these towns, starts speaking at these meetings and talking to audiences. And when he gets out of prison, because remember, he gets bailed out, he starts holding receptions at, like, hotels and halls. And
thank you for coming to my motivational lecture tour about how I am a rich man who has been deceived by the court system.
Yeah. Thanks for coming to my TED Talk about how give me money now, please.
I actually would have loved if he started doing a TED Talk series about how to scam everyone.
Well, I don't think he'd do well because he's clearly failed at it.
Because he failed at it,
so,
yeah.
But everybody is like, this is the guy, he's the heir, give him his money. And then they start up the Tichborne Defense Fund, which is, again, this system of bonds being sold. And that fund raises about 60,000 pounds.
Jesus Christ!
Now, the press in general is like, this guy's not for real.
This guy is not it. So he just gains, like, a weird little cult following more than anything else.
And, and the cult following starts trying to, like, make their own newspapers. They create two.
Hilarious.
Both very short-lived, called the Tichborne Gazette in May of 1872, and the Tichborne News and Anti-Oppression Journal in May of that year.
Hey, friends, this is really a single-issue publishing affair, and, like, I don't know that you really want to spend your money. You can't run a paper on a single issue. It's like, hi, we don't have Tumblr yet, right? Like,
they're the original single-issue voters.
Yeah, it's like...
stan culture. They love this man.
These people would have loved Twitter.
They would have loved Twitter.
These people would have loved Twitter.
They would have loved Twitter. Okay, so on April 23rd of 1873, the criminal trial begins. And it is known as Queen v. Thomas Castro, otherwise Arthur Orton, otherwise Sir Roger Charles Toddy Tichborne, because they don't know his name at this point.
Otherwise.
Yeah. It's also listed as Regina V. Castro, because that's like the crown, sometimes known as like Regina.
Because the regent. Yes.
And it is heard in the Queen's Bench, which is, you know, like the crown's court.
I think it's so funny in America when we have cases like this where it goes on to like the state level. Sometimes it is like, you know,
Pennsylvania,
Alabama versus whatever, or it's like the people versus, like, if it makes it up to like the Supreme Court. Great, love that. It's so funny when it's the Queen.
Yeah, it's
she's queen sitting there and she's going, "You're a liar and a scammer."
Well, sometimes it's known as like sometimes they'll say the Crown versus,
but still that now concept.
Of course, they would say the king, because
they
don't have a queen anymore. They're always just changing things up.
But it would just—it's so funny to me. The image that portrays is funny to me.
I know.
It's just her sitting there.
The same really as saying like the state versus.
Yes. Oh, that is also funny to me. It's just funnier to me to imagine the queen sitting there with all of the men in the silly little wigs,
and she's like, and she's
sitting on the bench going, "You are a scammer."
Yeah. Scammer.
Okay. Yes.
The trial is one of the lengthiest cases heard in an English court.
This man is just spending his life on trial, apparently. No. Months and months at a time.
I know. It begins on April 23rd, 1873. Another source said the 21st, but I found more sources that said the 23rd, so I'm going with that. And it ends on February 28th, 1874. It occupies 188 court days. And 311 days in total.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's almost a year.
Yeah.
Of just active court case.
Now, because of the rules that apply to criminal cases at this time, the claimant can be present in court, but he cannot testify. So that's different about this trial. They can't ask him questions.
Because now it's a criminal trial.
Right.
Right. Well, and also, if you're already on trial for perjury, what is the point of asking you questions in court, because you're clearly just going to lie again, and how can we listen to anything you have to say? Like,
maybe just keep it zipped, you know?
Yeah.
Now, away from court, he is loving his celebrity status.
Oh, I believe it.
He's in his influencer era.
Well, that's all he was looking for in the first place was money, so...
Totally. And, I just found this interesting...
It's our thumbs up. It's our once a show accidental thumbs up that Anna gives.
And... interestingly, the American writer, Mr. Mark Twain, is in London at the time, and he attends an event, and the claimant is also there. And he says that he, quote, thought him a rather fine and stately figure.
I don't know who this guy is,
but I he's like him.
Very rich for being on trial.
For lying and not being a rich person.
Yeah. Good for you for scamming the crown. That's a very American sentiment.
So... your man Hawkins is the prosecution. He's representing the crown. He calls 215 witnesses.
Ooh.
This includes people from France and from Chile, where he was traveling, and Australia and Wapping, And they all testify that either the claimant is not Roger Tichborne or that he is Arthur Orton. So they find people who are like, that's Arthur Orton. I know that guy. Right? Now, the defense. So his lawyer's name is Keneally. I think that's how you say it. And this guy is something else. His defense is that the claimant is actually just a victim of a conspiracy that includes the Catholic Church, the government, and the legal establishment.
Oh, just a fun, flirty little conspiracy. Okay, no, but I have a question about that.
Okay.
Goodness gracious, sorry, we have a bajillion emergency vehicles going down our road right now.
I heard it.
It was so loud. Okay, so why would... what was the list again? The Catholic Church, the government,
and the legal system.
The legal establishment care about this random man from Australia?
Well, Amanda, because he's trying to get a lot of money from a noble family.
Right.
I think if it weren't a family with a title, he probably wouldn't have gone that route. Although, I don't know, this guy... He's kooky. He might have gone that route anyway. He's like that kind of guy.
Right. Right. Everything is a conspiracy.
In the courtroom, like, is, you know, dramatic and, like, making accusations against the crown. And, you know, he's being a lot.
And the queen is sitting there and she doesn't like that very much.
She's watching and she hates it.
And she says, that's not very nice, young man.
Yeah, he's a lot. So, again, you can go read more about, like, the actual workings of the trial, but this is already long, so I'm not going to get into too many details. But the jury retires at noon on Saturday, February 28th. They come back in 30 minutes.
Yeah, they said, we've heard all we need to hear, thank you.
And they say, guilty on both counts of perjury. Sorry.
Yeah, they did. Hey, sometimes the system works. It often doesn't.
Yeah.
But sometimes this man does get caught in his lie.
Yeah. The judge refuses to allow the claimant to address the court, and he is sentenced to 2 consecutive terms of 7 years, 7 for each of the charges. So the first 7 and then the second sentence will kick in after that. Now, the jury did come back and say, they gave a statement where they were basically like, Keneally's whole treatment of the crown was actually really messed up, and we didn't like it. And it was, we really think that he should be punished. That was bad. He acted up, and it was not good. So, the verdict is out. And, of course, all the cult followers are up in arms. You know, there's a big crowd, like, when they take him from the courthouse and they're all out there.
Of course.
Like, free him, you know. And,
Hey, listen, it's, you know, it's the late 1800s. They weren't really hanging people so much anymore. And so
the
people were bored.
Yeah, and to your earlier point, later on, author and poet George Bernard Shaw, your man from Ireland, writes about how weird it is. Like, there's this big paradox about the claimant being perceived simultaneously as a legitimate baronet and a working class man denied his legal rights by a ruling elite. Like,
it's
this
wild.
Is not
it's
lost
wild.
On people observing the situation.
It doesn't make any sense.
It
doesn't
know.
Make any sense.
Yeah.
The people were bored.
Now, just a quick note about the claimant's lawyer, the guy, Keneally. He loses his career, basically.
Yeah.
They're like, nobody wants you anymore. And, you know, you're talking in open court about bribery and how the crown is out to get your client. Like, nobody's going to work with you.
Yeah.
But he becomes really popular amongst the claimant's supporters.
Of course.
He goes on his lecture tour. He's telling everybody about the case. He draws really big crowds. He becomes really popular among the working class. The Liberal government is defeated in the next election largely because of this case. Because
that's
now there are people being like, you're
wild.
The liberal elite. We don't like it.
That's wild.
This man is elected a member of parliament in 1875.
Okay, so he's lawyer. Okay, so he's Donald Trump.
Well, no, because Donald Trump could never become a lawyer.
You know? Right. But like, but you know what I'm saying? Like,
you're acting like Trump had a legitimate career before.
No, he didn't. That's different. But this guy also didn't seem to have a terribly legitimate career before because he was making cases like this.
Well, I don't know that he was, actually. Mm. I think he just dug really hard into the defense because he didn't have another one.
But you see what I mean, though.
I don't know what his career was like before this. You have to think that he had some sort of a good reputation because, you know, the claimant hired him because he thought he could defend him well.
Yeah.
So I think that he didn't have another defense. He wanted to go for the dramatics because oftentimes in court, it's about who tells the best story, you know?
Uh-huh.
And then I think because he lost his job, basically, the only thing he could do, because he was popular among this big group of people, was to just dive
make a public career out of it. Yeah.
Right. 72 petitions containing over 200,000 names are presented to the House of Commons when Keneally makes a motion for a royal commission of inquiry into the Tichborne case. The commission is voted down. Mm-hmm. The rest of Parliament is like, no, we're not doing that.
Baby girl, nobody cares about this as much as you do. Thank you seriously. So much.
And then, you know, there's like this big Tichborne movement, right? Where it's like this cult following of people. There's a big market created from it with, you know, souvenirs. Like they make medallions and China figurines and tea cloths and all kinds of memorabilia. And then interest in the case kind of declines by 1880, and in the general election of that year, Keneally is defeated. He actually dies of heart failure before polling even closes in the election, so it wouldn't have mattered, I guess, anyway, but it's not good. So the claimant, who we now know to be, or largely consider to be, Arthur Orton, because many people testify that that's who it was.
Okay. So then that other name, that Thomas whatever, was just a fake name he was using when he was in Australia.
He just made it up, or he got it from somebody else there and was using it. He is in prison from 1874 to 1884, so he only serves 10 years, and he's released on October 11th. After his release, he signs a contract to tour with music halls and circuses.
So he just wanted to be a celebrity.
I guess,
he just wanted to be rich.
I think he was just bored.
He was like, I want to be rich. I'm going to pretend to be this rich guy and take all of his family's money. And then when that didn't work, he just dove in. He's Roxy Hart. Like, full Chicago on it.
He is Roxy Hart. He's so Roxy Hart.
We both reached for the gun, you know, like.
He so is. That's hilarious. Yeah, but the British public's interest in him has really dipped. In 1886, he goes to New York, doesn't really end up doing much there. He becomes a bartender for a little while. And then he comes back to England in 1887, where he marries a music hall singer, Lily Inever. Despite the fact that, by the way, Amanda, he's still married.
Yeah, and has kids.
You remember Marianne Bryant, the person he married in Australia? Yeah, he's still married to her. He's been married this whole time. I don't know what her deal was. I don't know if she was, like, supporting him or if she was like, this dude's actually crazy. I'm just going to go live somewhere else with my kids. I don't know. But it seems like they weren't together at least after he was released from prison. They certainly lived apart. So I don't know. In 1895, for a fee of a few hundred pounds, he confesses to the newspaper, The People, that he was Arthur Orton.
Wow. Thank you so much for telling us what we all already knew, my man.
Don't get too excited. So with the proceeds, he opens a small tobacconist's shop in Islington or Elington. I never know how to say that one. Then he retracts the confession and says, actually, just kidding, I am Roger Tichborne, I wasn't.
Well, okay.
He cannot admit that it wasn't him. The shop fails, he tries to open a few other businesses, they don't really work out, And on April 1st of 1898, he dies of heart disease, totally destitute.
And he died on April Fool's Day.
His life was the biggest joke of them all. Which is the day this episode comes out, I just realized.
Oh my gosh!
That's crazy! I didn't even realize.
I love that.
Oh my gosh.
It's kismet.
There's a little bit of a spike in interest in him again because of the funeral. Around 5,000 people attend at Paddington Cemetery, where he's buried.
Paddington Bear? That's so tragic.
Yeah. He's buried there in an unmarked pauper's grave.
It's iconic.
I found this interesting. Somebody wrote that in a, quote, act of extraordinary generosity, the Tichburn family allows a card bearing the name Sir Roger Charles Doughty Tichburn to be placed on the coffin before its interment. And the name Tichburn is registered in the cemetery's records.
Wow. That's wild
really
to me.
Interesting.
Especially because really it's like the actual guy, it seems very likely that he died tragically at sea.
Yeah,
and so he never got any kind of funeral or burial or grave. And now this random guy who was lying about him,
I think,
bears his name on his tombstone. That's
not on his tombstone, but in the registry or whatever.
That's crazy.
It's not even like you could look it up and find the grave. It's just that like a Tichborne is buried here somewhere.
Right.
Basically,
that's wild.
I think that they felt sorry for him. I think they did by the end because they were like, "Man, this guy is Delulu. He clearly doesn't have anybody or anything in his life.
So
he has no money at this point." I think they just felt sorry for him.
Did they ever figure out why he knew, like, why he decided to pretend to be this guy?
No.
Like, did he?
He never told anybody.
Travel with him in South America, and then when he got to Australia, maybe other people survived that wreck, but he didn't. So he pretended to be him.
To think he just saw one of the ads in the paper and thought it was an opportunity to get money.
And then just started doing his research so he could get some.
It's not the first time that someone pretended to be a rich person from just seeing an ad like this person's missing. Can you?
But he put in a little bit of research there. Like, he knew enough to like make up some stories in court and to convince a handful of people that would have actually known. Not like
also,
the weird masses that he had going. Like
that
handful of like soldiers that he was able to kind of convince were him. Like, that's strange.
I personally think that it started as he was just trying to get some money. He saw it as an opportunity. He learned a little. And I think he, at a certain point, fully convinced himself that he was this guy. Like, he bought into his own lie.
Yeah.
Because clearly he's, like, not, you know, settled as a person.
Yeah.
So I think he just bought into
it. Was like,
it,
why couldn't I be him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there wasn't, when it started, when he made the claim, there was like, there was no one to refute it at first.
Because the mom was all in on it.
Yeah. I think he thought once he convinced the mom that that would be it. It would be that easy.
But then she died on him.
Well, and she didn't have any power to give him what he wanted
because the title had already moved on.
Right.
Yeah, it had already moved on.
Her husband didn't have the title. Her husband was dead, so it's not like he could be like, "All right, honey, well, if you believe it, then okay."
He can be next in line. Yeah.
Right. But wasn't the case.
It's wild.
So, and poor Roger's just lost
out there in the ocean somewhere.
In time, I don't think he survived. I mean,
mm-mm.
I don't. It wasn't even fully confirmed that a ship picked people up and took them to Australia. That was just hearsay.
A theory.
Nobody knows for sure if that happened. So that's the Tichborne case.
It's wild. Wild.
I was so excited when I found this story. I was like, "That's so interesting."
Weird.
I
liked
it. So yeah. Needed the drama.
Weird one. It's great.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah. He was the ultimate scammer.
Well, it was a long one.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of detail. And again, I left a lot out about the actual, like, proceedings and stuff. Because I was just like, there were a lot of names, a lot of witnesses. I couldn't go into everything. But
yeah.
So I hope everybody enjoyed it. No clue what's coming next. Hey, as per usual. But if you have suggestions for us, for other topics, you can email us at rememberthatpod@gmail.com. You can also find us on the internet at RTTpods. Oh, wow. None of that was right. At RTTpod. We're on Threads and Instagram. And we would love it if you would leave us a rating and review wherever you listen to this podcast. And if you want to find me on the internet, I am at The Real Anna Webb.
And I'm at ACW Nerdfighter.
Whew. That one was a lot. My face got really warm.
Talking it up.
Yeah, plus drinking a little bit of wine. My face got really flush.
Yeah.
But we did it. We got through it.
Yes, we did.
And until next time.
Remember that time.